Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
What is going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Before we start, you know the score. Hit subscribe, give us some comments in the reviews, whatever you can do. Share it with your mate. Share it with people. That would mean the world. I'd love you forever if you did that. This week on the podcast, I'm really excited about this one. It's really nice to see this podcast kind of get to a point where I can ask artists at the level of this next guest and they open their arms and say, I'd absolutely love to. Cascade. One of the biggest names in electronic music ever, which is crazy. He's had insane success when it comes to releasing music, playing shows. And I wanted to get him on the podcast and talk about it because he's had an amazing story. And we all know with what happens with amazing success is how hard somebody works and the hard times and what you miss out on. And I really wanted to get him on the podcast and talk about that. And it was an amazing conversation. I really liked it. I learned a lot. I learned a lot of things that I didn't know about him. And we just, had some really great candid conversations as well. So without further ado, Cascade. Third time lucky.
Sorry.
I think
Jeez, dude. The
last time was my fault because I didn't look at the time.
We're here and it's happening now. And that's all that really matters. It's all happening.
This is true. How you doing, man?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
Yeah, really good, man. Thank you for coming on. It's great to have you on. And it's great to actually, like, I don't think we've met in person. I don't think we met before.
Which is crazy to me. I'm sure we've probably passed one another. I don't know, at a festival or in the airport or something. And I was probably too asleep to even notice.
Story of our lives, right? Touring life.
You're right. Yeah.
Where are you in the world right now?
I'm home. I'm here in LA and it's raining a lot here. Mm. We're in the middle of some kind of atmospheric river. It's been raining for 2 days straight. Which is unusual, but yeah, I'm based here in Los Angeles. I have been for, 11, 12 years. Oh, wow. I've got a studio in Santa Monica. I'm here on the west side, right close to the ocean, nice. Which is where I prefer to be.
Do you surf?
I do. I grew up skateboarding and doing all that and snowboarding and whatnot. And then, like every person, when they moved to California, I bought a surfboard. Actually, my wife bought it for me as a birthday present. And I was like, yes. I'm like, what are you saying? You want me to surf? Surfing is really, really, really hard. Yeah. Really hard. And I I'm so bummed that I found it so late in life because I love it more than anything. But really, when I found it, you know, when I moved here, whatever, 12 years ago, I would do it like 3 or 4 times a year, and I would suck because it would be so hard. And I'd be like, this is impossible. So during COVID, I have a house that's actually in San Clemente, which is kind of like America's surf capital. Kelly Slater's got a house there. And I was like, this is it. This is my chance to actually surf. So for that year, I mean, for the first 5 or 6 months, I stayed here in my house in LA and like, was like, it's going to open back up any minute. And like, I was producing a ton of music and streaming and stuff. And then when it was pretty apparent that like, oh yeah, this isn't happening and my kids aren't going back to school, I was like, all right, we're going down to the beach house and I'm going to surf every day. So I surfed like 5-6 days a week for about a year. And that's really kind of when I got into it. So yeah, very late in life.
Amazing. There's something you said something that's like, it's very, very hard. There's something about doing hard things later on in life that sucks even more so from when you're from what I remember from when you're a kid. Like I went to see my niece and nephews play rugby. Like I'm from like a big rugby family, and on the weekend, and I was just like, I'd love to go and play rugby again. I'd absolutely love to, but I know how hard it's gonna be, and the thought of just being absolutely battered like the day after, the week after, it's just so demoralizing, especially getting a little bit older. And it's just like, I don't know if I can do that.
Yeah. The recovery time is totally different.
Yeah.
Like you get beat up and yeah. I mean, I used to skateboard a lot. I grew up skating. That was kind of my go-to sport.
Yeah.
And as I got older, I just like less and less, I still go out and skate a little bit now, but man, it's just when you fall, I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is gonna hurt for like 2 weeks now. So yeah, I don't do it as much. That's why I prefer surfing, because I don't get as beat up and it keeps me in better condition.
Yeah,
honestly, I think the best condition I've ever been in my life was that year during COVID. I was like walking around with my shirt off, just like, what up, man?
Feeling great. Like,
yeah, like look at me, I'm a poster for health.
Yeah. It's interesting though, when you actually have time for yourself, or because we all can make time for ourselves, right? We can all make a choice to go to the gym, to be fit and healthy, and to kind of have that way of life. But life gets caught up, and it's very easy to kind of get caught back on the rat race of touring and all of the kids and all of the family stuff that you have to do and everything like that, writing music, etc., etc. And then you forget that, like, the health generally always comes last in a lot of situations. That is, I don't know if you're the same. I have to train. I have to go to the gym. But there's a level of, like, it's really hard to stay healthy.
It's insanely hard. There's a couple things there. I learned that the hard way, because I got really unhealthy. You know, when I was a kid, whatever, it's easy when you're in like middle school, grade school, high school, like I'm doing all these sports. I played soccer, because version of football, whatever, and I track and field, and I was doing all this stuff. Then when you graduate, and kind of that's when I started going into the studio more.
Yeah.
And there was like probably a window of like 3 or 4 years where I just sat in my basement and didn't do anything except try and figure out how to make music.
Yeah.
And like I was just eating pizza, and I was playing a few gigs just at my local pub at that time. So it's like that's the only time I left the house. And like, I look at pictures from back then and I'm just like, wow, who is that person? I don't know. But I think honestly, this is for me, I have this conversation every once in a while with guys that are kind of starting out. I'm like, look, the thing that I had trouble with, like my biggest kind of caution of people getting into this when I talk to young dudes, is that it's when you do what you love, it's so hard to say no.
Yeah.
Like even like, dude, I've been in this industry almost 30 years. And like, even to this day, you know, my manager's emailing me this or that and these different offers. It's like, I say yes to so much. It's been this huge challenge and like something that has been very costly to me to learn this is to, no, you got to say no, you got to, you know, you got to make sure you have time to train, hit the gym, do your things and have your life on the side.
Yeah.
Because if you do what you love, it just can take over everything. I mean, there was a huge period of my career where I really didn't have much of a life outside of the studio and touring.
Yeah.
It's like the little bit of time that I did have was like going to my wife and children, but they were only getting a little because it's like I had all this other stuff and my career was just on this crazy, like when that whole EDM boom happened, I was just like, people actually want to pay me to do this? Like a lot of money? This is nuts. Like for sure, this is not going to be here tomorrow. I have to take this show. You don't understand. This is no way somebody will pay me this amount of money 2 years from now or a year from now. So I just was like, yes, yes, yes. And that snowballed into like at one point I'm like, wait, what am I, what, you know, I remember an interviewer asked me like, what do you do in your free time? I'm like, free time? What the free time? People have that? That's like a thing? And I'm like, in my previous life, I used to like skate and snowboard. And I mean, I didn't say that. I played it cool. It was like, oh yeah, go snowboarding. But at that point, I was like,
hadn't been
snowboarding. I'd only ridden like 3 days that season, or I hadn't ridden in a few years, you know? So it's, anyway, that's it's always tough, my cautionary tale.
It's tough though, isn't it? Because I think in hindsight, right? And I guess, yeah, it's a pretty fair question. Would you have changed it if you could go and do it all again? Would you change anything?
No.
Yeah,
I wouldn't.
And I knew that would be the answer, because I think that's the thing, is like there comes a point, and I see it through touring, I see it in myself, I see it in friends, and I see it having these conversations that at some point in everyone's career, there is that hustle. And I hate kind of using that word, or dislike using that word, but there's that period in their life where nothing else matters. And you have to go through that to get out the other side and to get to the point where you can sit back and go, yeah, you know what, that was fucking crazy, but it's got me to where I'm at. If you didn't do that stage in your career and you took it easy, you kind of did that, the road could have looked very different for you.
I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you.
No.
But you have to have, I've been following John Summit's career for a while now. Yeah. One, because he grew up not far from where I grew up. He's a, you know, suburban Chicago kid. He grew up in Naperville. I grew up in Northbrook. He's like right down the road from me.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of fascinated with, he's a cool guy and I think he's talented, and I'm enjoying kind of watching this, you know, kid from the neighborhood kind of have a moment that's enjoyable for me. And he said something like this, you know, I'm just grinding so hard right now. And he's in that, right? He's in that pocket.
Yeah.
And it's like, what he was saying is that, you know, I'm glad that I worked in the professional world. He was a CPA, I think, before, you know, doing people's taxes and whatnot. Cause it's like, it taught me dedication and hard work, you know, staying at the office till like 10 o'clock at night to get it done and meet those deadlines. He understood that. I think from the outside, you look at this and it just, people are like, oh my gosh, you know, popping bottles, making beats, whatever, check me out in the studio. It's all fun and games. It's like, no, there's a period of time when you really are just like getting run through this machine and just beat up and you know, so dedicated to make it work or you believe in the dream, or you believe in music you're making, or whatever, you know, whatever, everyone's got a different story. But if you don't, if you're not willing to do that, it's probably not going to happen for you.
Yeah.
I mean, you really got to give it all.
No, I agree. And I think everybody in their own niche world, and I don't think it's just music. I think it's in every walk of life. If there wants to be a level of, I don't know if the success is the right word, because it depends what success is to that you as an individual. But like, if you want something that's going to last a long time, that hard work, that grind has to be put in at some point, somehow. And what I am interested in asking you is, do you ever feel like now you're not, I know you still work bloody hard and you kind of, but your life's changed. Do you ever feel lazy?
Yeah. Yes. It really, for me, I'll tell you when the big change was for me. When people are like, well, what was that grind? Was that a few years? No, I think there's a decade or more. What was really just nothing but this. I wake up, I knew what I had to do, and I was going to sleep with like the list for tomorrow. Like, okay, I got to finish that song, or I got to finish this remix, or I got to go into the studio. Okay, I got to buy tickets for this show that's coming up, or whatever it was. You know, it was just always, there was always... Yeah. Another thing, the list just kept growing. We have that period of time. I kind of lost my train of thought of where I wanted to take that.
It was talking about being lazy, the feeling of being lazy now, and what you're saying.
So COVID happens, right? And COVID for me happened at like the most, it was, I think, kind of like saved my life, the irony of that, because I was so beat up from the road, because I was having so many opportunities come through and I just was having a hard time managing that. So when everything turned off, it was a moment for me to kind of like take a step back, and it still took me a couple months to like decompress and unwind and have some perspective. Like, really, am I really going to do 200 shows this year? Like, what's the point, man? You know, I need to relax. I need to just kind of like, okay. And then it was like, okay, I don't want to do that remix, or I just want to focus on this EP or whatever. So as things settled down and I kind of got a rhythm and I got surfing all the time and got really healthy physically, I was like, okay, cool. When I go back, here's the number that I'm going to do. This is it. This is the amount of shows that I want to do that I think will fit in my schedule. And here's how much music I'm going to set aside. How much time I'm going to set aside to make music. Whatever comes out of that, cool. If that's an album, if that's an EP, if that's one remix, whatever it is, that's it. Here it is. And then I did a year of that and I was like, okay, cool. And then last year I kind of went back and reconstructed that, like, oh, a little bit more of this and a little bit less of that. So I think for the first time in my career, you know, whatever, 30 years later, I'm like, I'm kind of at a good pace, but certainly when I look back at the old me who was doing 200 plus shows a year, I can feel a little bit lazy, but I also feel like I've earned that. Like, I don't, like, dude, I have this amazing facility 10 minutes from my house, the studio that it's literally the studio of my dreams. 8 years ago, I did a big Vegas deal and I got a massive check up front. And I was like, I mean, I'm here at my kitchen counter right now. Yeah. And that's where I've done a lot of my writing, is at the dining room table or the kitchen table, on my laptop, a couple synths, like. So I have so many sessions that were done that way. So I was like, I'm going to build this place out. And what's crazy is it sits empty 80% of the time.
Yeah.
And there's no guilt there anymore. Before I'd be like, oh my gosh, I got to get there. Even though I've been gone for a week in South America, I come back and like, yeah, okay, I'm going to take a couple of days, hang out with my family, whatever. Oh, maybe I'll get one day this week at the studio. And like before COVID, there was a lot of guilt with that.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, I got to get there. I've got this, the facility of my, the studio of my dreams is right down the street. Like I got to get there and use it. Now I'm like, nah, it's cool. If I don't make it there this week, I've got a day and a half planned next week. That's fine.
What was the process in that mindset? Because I'm still trying to work that out, if I'm honest, and I need all the help with that, is that process of, nah, it's okay. You're doing all right.
Oh, man. Well, listen, for me, it was having time away from it during the lockdowns was key for me, but also where I'm at in my career, which I'm a madman in the way that for years, for people listening, look, North America has always been my stomping ground because I'm from Chicago. I've lived in California for 20 plus years. Yeah. I was in San Francisco for 10 years. I've been down here for 12 years, whatever. I was in Orange County for a few years. So really, the bulk of my touring happens in Canada, US, Mexico, some South America stuff, and some Asia stuff. As you kind of whittle that down, like the tricky thing with America is like, dude, there's 30 markets you can hit here.
Yeah, it's massive.
That's a lot. And it's a lot of traveling.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, cool. I'm only going to hit 12 markets this year of that. And, you know, I just kind of had to like get comfortable with like, yeah, cool. I'm only going to play St. Louis once every 3 years.
Yeah.
Like that's just, I can't, I can only go to Dallas. I can only hit maybe Dallas. I can't hit Dallas, Houston, Austin. I can't hit all of these every single year. I mean, there's four or five cities in Texas you could hit.
Yeah.
San Antonio. I mean, and listen, these are all, dude, I'm sure you can relate to this. They're all, these are scenes that are worthy of hitting. Totally. I mean, you get 1,000 kids in a room that haven't seen me for 3 years. They're pulling their hair out.
Yeah.
I'm dropping some song that's 5 years old, and these kids are flipping out because they've never been in the room with me. Rinse it, and like it's a moment for them. That song means something to them. So I kind of had to like figure out how to let go. And I don't, listen, I don't have it totally figured out, because you can see I'm talking about this, it's still hard for me. It's still like, ah, man, how can I make to these places? And it's just kind of prioritizing the stuff that's really important. Like, cool, I know New York, Miami, Chicago, San Francisco. Like, I take my top like 8 markets in America. Okay, I know I gotta hit them. Then I talk my top 2 or 3 in Canada. I gotta hit Vancouver, I gotta hit Toronto. Okay, cool. You know, Mexico City, okay, I got to go there once this year, you know, and then it's like my handful of Asia places. And then it's like cool, few random opportunities that pop up that are just awesome. Yeah. And I'll leave room for that stuff. And I think putting that in first, because then it's like studio time is easier to kind of oh, I can have this fit in here. That can mold around these other big important pieces. I don't know. It's really, it's hard. But I think I have a little bit of an advantage because like I've done it. I've been doing it for a long time. I don't know. I tried like for many years, dude, a big thing that kind of like was this huge weight on me that I was carrying around was how can I break into Europe?
Yeah.
My records just like weren't working as well there as they were here.
Yeah.
But then not only that, like I just was having a hard time finding, part of it was my problem. Like I wouldn't go there and play all the clubs that have 500, 600, 700 kids that are important to play that kind of like ignite that fire and get fans there. Like, man, Cascade came here and he smashed it. I'll go listen to his thing or I'll pay attention to him. Like I just wasn't giving it the time. So for over a decade, I was like, trying to make that happen. So I would spend a month over there, like messing around. And like, I just didn't have the right partnerships or the right look or whatever, but I still kept dedicating time to it. At one point I was just like, all right, I need to let these go. I need to
It's hard though, isn't it? Because I like in it, and I'm actually really glad you brought that up about Europe, because I have the same conversation with my team about Europe, which is strange for me because obviously I'm English and my biggest market is America. And it has been since I started touring full time, since I became a full time DJ, my biggest market was America. And I've never been able to crack that Europe kind of scene. And I'm still at the point where I'm still trying to. I'm still like hopeful that there's an opportunity there. But what was that moment in your life where you're like, you know what, it doesn't matter in the bigger picture of your life anymore? Like, how did you get to that point?
Dude, I think I'm still having that conversation with myself. Is that crazy?
It's so weird.
It doesn't make any sense. It's so stupid. I think I have to constantly convince myself that, like, it's okay. It's all right.
Yeah.
But let me kind of tell you where my head's at. Let me like zoom out a little bit, because to me, there's a few different ways that it happens, right? Like I look at like Paul Fisher, right? He had a massive global hit.
Yeah.
Everyone was listening to Lose It. And then the track before was even a smash, dude. That's the one where I started paying attention. Like, damn, this is freaking cool.
Yeah.
You know, Barkley put it out, Roller Coaster. And I was like, oh, this is some shit, dude. This is dope, man. What is this? Who is this? You know, like I knew Cut Snake and I knew what they're doing. And then, oh, that's him. Okay, he's doing this, whatever. So I'm putting it together. But he had that kind of global smash, so then he could kind of step back in his team and design where they want to put their time into, right? Mm. Because wherever he goes, there's going to be a lot of people that are interested in, like, will show up at the club or festival to hear him drop that track and everybody goes crazy. Hold on. Everybody loses it. So I think everyone in this industry probably secretly hopes and that the track they're working on will do that and have some major impact. And then they can kind of design where they want to spend their time.
Yeah.
I think there's those lightning bolt moments, or lightning in a bottle moments only happen every so often, like every year or two, there's a dude who comes around who puts some song out that just like has global impact in from our scene. I mean, all the way back from like Robin S. Show Me Love, you know, 30 years ago, boom, she put that out. It's like, to, you know, let's say Losing It or whatever, or even John Summit tracks, this song that he's on right now. So those moments happen, but I think what happens more regularly, it's where you're at and where you put the time in.
Yeah.
Dude, things happened for me in California because I was living in San Francisco and I was like playing my local market, putting out records. I was signed to a label in San Francisco. They were putting me on showcases. I had my friends coming out. I was young. All my friends were working professionally. So, you know, I'm in my mid-20s, late-20s. So like when I played at the club, all my boys came out. It was a freaking rager Friday night. Oh my gosh, this is sick. Promoters like, can we do this again in a month? Yes. Bah, fast forward a month. And it builds from there. Mm. This guy's got something going on. Cool. The guy invites me down to San Diego. My boys take the train down. We all go. There's 20 of us. Wow, it's crazy. I know some kids in San Diego. And then these things start happening. That's how it happens for most of us out there. It's like building these small moments and they get put together and then people start paying attention to your music and promoters believe in you. So I think the idea of having this like global thing happen that way is so hard to like construct or try and be the architect behind that. It's almost impossible. Yeah. Yes, it happens every once in a while, sure. But really, I feel like it's these guys that get, you know, there's a lot of luck in there where some track just resonates with millions of people, and then they can kind of design where they want to spend their time.
Yeah.
So for the rest of us, I don't know, man, it's do what you can do, get in where you fit in. Do you feel, this is a question for you, do you feel like it was happening in America for A, because you were making American sound, they were more American style records, or because you were putting records out on American labels and they were inviting you to their parties and you were part of their showcases or their campouts or whatever they were doing, so you were getting exposed to their kind of built-in audience. Do you think that was the case with you?
100%. Yeah, I say this every time, like my touring career, not my career, but my touring career started when I signed records to Dirty Bird, and that was a specific choice by me of where can I sign my records that can give me a, can help grow my career in a market.
Right.
And that was what I chose to do, and it worked for me. And I will always thank Barclay and the Dirty Bird crew at that time for helping me grow my career to where it is. Even though I don't release music on Dirty Bird anymore and my sound has changed massively, but that allowed that allowed me to have a foundation in America, which I didn't have a foundation elsewhere. However, I do also think the way the business works in America compared to Europe is, and this is, I'd like to get your thoughts on this, but my thoughts of American agents compared to European agents just work very differently. And I don't want to kind of talk shit on anybody at all, but American, from my experience, and I can only talk about my own experience, but I find American agents are willing to work on a project long term and grow it from the bottom, not jump on something just because it's successful at this time. Where my experience in European UK agents is that they'd take you on, but they're not really willing to work until something really is popping off in that market. That's purely my opinion, and that's all my experience. So I think also the beautiful side of capitalism in America is something that isn't really the same in Europe and America and England, when agents just want to fucking hustle. That's it. And I think there's a dedication to of agents in that way, where even if it's going to be a shit offer, even if it's a shit show that they're off putting on the table, they're still putting offers on the table just to show that they're doing their job. And I think there's kind of difference in that.
Yeah. My experience has been similar to yours with that. And I think, and I'm not to say that America's any better.
No, not at all.
Capitalism. I think what the deal is there is, dude, we caught on to dance music so much later.
Yeah.
Like, even though we were in it, listen, dude.
You started it.
I turned 53 this month. I grew up in Chicago. I was in high school from 85 to 89.
Yeah.
The stuff I was seeing in the clubs, dude, I started going out when I was 15 years old.
Yeah.
I saw, dude, Frankie Knuckles was a resident at the teen club I was going to as a 16-year-old kid. I'm in there like, Frankie Knuckles is smashing it. Like, I mean, I'm listening. I had no idea what I was a part of, because it just, to me, that's like, that's what my reality was. I didn't know that this was some first wave of some movement that was taking over the world. I had no idea. But look, the scene here remained small for decades, but it kept it in a way that it was kind of cool. Like, we had this little niche thing, like, that was just kind of doing its thing, and you could make a living.
Yeah.
You know, nobody was going to make a lot of money. When I got into this, I was like, I'll never own a home. but I'll be able to get a nice apartment and like, oh, I can make a living.
Yeah.
And I was totally satisfied with that because I was doing it because I loved it. I was like, oh, if I press some records. And back then I was doing bootlegs. I was mashing up tracks and pressing records. I was making more money doing that than I was gigging. You know, so I was like, I was hustling on that thing and whatever. But I think the agent's mindset here is they've seen this slow growth and this burn. So they're like, oh, cool. If we put the time into this, you know, I mean, dude, the guys that manage John Summit right now, they were two tech bros.
Yeah.
You know, 5 years ago, they just found this guy on SoundCloud, like, hey, dude, you're doing some pretty cool stuff. Let me, this dude had nothing going on.
Yeah.
He, just some kid with a day job, and they liked the sound. They're like, let's get with this guy. We'll help him make it grow. Man, good choice, smart thing. And I'm sure they worked hard for those opportunities, but it was like it worked. I think in the UK, you guys, and just Europe in general, like, dude, in the 80s, the stuff crossed over.
Yeah.
Top of the Pops, I look at this stuff of Farley, Jack, Master Funk, like playing on TV, like these old things. I'm just like, my mind, it's hard to even imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just so, and it's awesome. There's, that's, you know, two different stories. One's not better than the other. They're just both amazing. But I think the agents now, every time I meet, you know, let's rewind 10, 15 years ago in my career where I was really starting, things were really starting to click here. And I'd be going to Miami for Winter Music Conference, Miami Music Week, whatever we're calling this thing. And I'm meeting with these European agents who have big acts around Europe. And they're like, yeah, you got something going on, but there's, you know, there's a little bit of buzz here for you.
Yeah.
They're like, let me try you out.
Yeah.
And their version of tryout is like, they would kind of just like glob me on to these. They already had like a roster that's just like rinsing it, you know, making tons of money. So they would just like throw me on these little things. I mean, dude, I've opened up for Guetta, for Morales. I played at Pasha, a summer residency where I was opening up for the Def Mix guys. You know, nobody knows who I am. And I'm in there trying to like make my way. Then the Swedes, when they were first coming up, like I was getting on a lot of their stuff in Europe, opening up for them. And you know, and none of it really panned out. But I think the agents thinking were, you know, whatever, I'll toss this kid a bone. And then if it like starts to catch, then I'll be here.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they weren't the only way they could do anything with me is to, you know, just kind of attach me to that. I mean, they're just throwing me, you know, a few hundred bucks here, $400. And like, I was willing to put the time in to see if I could get something to happen. But listen, back then the world was a lot less connected. Like I didn't have much social media to even take advantage of those opportunities.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't show myself like, oh, I'm here at Pasha.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that.
I totally agree. And I think also, sorry to butt in, but I think, what you were saying about electronic music being on TV over here and it being commercial to a certain extent. And although electronic music, house music, techno came from America and European culture kind of took it, and especially Great Britain with rave culture and everything like that, I feel like nobody looks to America as oh, we need to see what America's doing when it comes to electronic music. Like I live in Detroit, or I used to live in Detroit. I will be moving back there soon, but I had a housemate at one point who actually edits this podcast, and he's like an insane techno producer, absolutely insane techno producer. Like one of the best that I've heard, like just sonically, technically, his live show is amazing. But he's like, the issue is everybody in America that's booking techno is looking at what Europe's doing. And they're not looking at what's in their back door. And you go to Europe,
dude.
You go to Europe and England, and it's, nobody's looking at going, oh my God, there's this new kid from Detroit that's releasing this sick music. Like, what is going is, oh, this new kid from Berlin, or this new kid from Bristol, or this new kid from London, or this new kid from wherever, apart from America. And it's really weird. And I'm not saying that there's right or wrong. I think it's a really nice conversation to have. But it just purely is that I think there's multiple factors in it. But America in electronic music, although some of the biggest artists in the world, yourself including one of them, right, are from North America, yet, and can sell more tickets than most people in Europe, yet that just doesn't correlate in European or British dance music culture, which is strange to me.
It's baffling. And I have a few acts to grind with this. Like, dude, I could talk about this for, and I love having your vantage point, because you spent some time here.
Yeah.
But you're from over there. So it's like, you have a really interesting perspective. And honestly, when you hit me up to do the podcast, I was like, oh man, I'd love to have some of these conversations, because your perspective is so, it's interesting to me. It's fascinating. And I feel like as the scene kind of crested here in America and it's kind of crossed over now, and when I say crossed over, we still don't have a ton of dance music on the radio here. It's not considered pop music. We're still definitely like the redheaded stepchild of the music world. Like, yeah, you guys are cool, but it's not really music, really, you know? So we don't have a ton of respect here, but we are moving a lot of tickets and things. We are moving the needle. I mean, dude, Illenium, kid from Denver, just did two nights at SoFi Stadium.
Crazy.
It's over 70,000 tickets. I mean, that's pop act numbers. That's undeniable. And I love seeing him do that. Another aspect of what you were saying, which has fascinated me, because it's been this little seed of resentment here, is that here in the US, I believe that most kids in the scene, like the general kid who's going out, dance music is a European thing.
Yeah.
Oh, we don't do that. Oh, he plays those European records. He does. They have no idea of the history, where it came from. You know, we've got a rich history of dance music here. They don't know any of that. It's just seen as something that's European. Oh, I went on a backpacking trip. Dude, they had like dance music on the radio, and kids we went out and they took ecstasy. Like, that's most Americans' knowledge of dance music.
EDM culture.
Which is a shame. Yeah. It's just like, I want to cry when I hear this. I'm like, dude, we're grinding. We're doing cool stuff over here too, man.
Yeah.
But with that, there's a lack of pride of American artists.
Yeah.
And the reason that bothers me is because I came up here, this has been my place, and it bums me out that, like, when Guetta goes and plays Paris, it's a holiday. They shut the streets down. They call off work. It's a bank. I mean, dude, the guy plays and 15 million people show up. The whole country has a party. Like, look at this guy. He's on the world stage. He's a French man, a Parisian that did it. He's on the world stage. He went to the Grammys. It's like, Americans could care less, dude. I mean, dude, I have fans hit me up all the time. Like, I thought you were from Europe. What are you kidding me? I couldn't be any more American. Like, I got to get like a bald eagle tattooed on my right up here. Like, you know what I'm saying? USA. Yeah. Like, because I make house music, I'm European. Like, bro, give me a break, man. I'm from Chicago. Like, I can't. I'm eating a hot dog right now. I couldn't be any more American. And the reason that's a little bit of a bummer is because I feel like a lot of these Americans coming up could lean into that pride and sell more tickets and get a little bit more of a lift if there was some of that pride involved, where I feel like, you know, same thing. The French have a lot of pride about Daft Punk and the Cridamore sound and how that happened and what that is. Even dude, in Detroit, I mean, dude, it took so long for that festival, DMF, you know, to like really sprout and have like a moment. Now it's up and running and it's cool and people respect it and it's awesome. But it's like, that thing should have been going on for 30 years. And yes, there should be 500,000 people showing up and because what it represents, you know, a city with an insane history.
With that is, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because it is almost like, I don't know. I think we're probably the wrong people to kind of be talking, not talking about it, but hooting and hollering about it. Purely because we're a bunch of white dudes, but and also I'm not from America, but I think having Kevin Saunderson on the podcast, having Gene Farris, having Josh Wink on the podcast, having
dude, I would love to hear like what Kevin has to say about something like that. Like they have to be 10 times more resentful towards the fact that they don't get celebrated like they should.
Exactly.
I mean, at least me, I've made a living. I'm sitting here in my freaking fat house in West LA. Like I've made a good life. So it's like, cool. I need to check myself. Like, dude, I am thankful. I have been given so much.
Yeah.
Thank you for all the people that came before me and they paved the road. Dude, I would not be sitting here talking to you with all these guys who came before me. And which, by the way, a lot of Americans and Europeans, it's like all these guys kind of set this up to where it could become some massive thing that it is today. So props to all of them. I think just it's a bit of a bummer that some of these guys that kind of paved the way and beat down so many doors didn't get kind of the respect that they deserve.
I totally agree, and it amazes me. It amazes me on, but I also think there was a point in American dance music culture where it just became very commercialized, and the fruits, everyone had the fruits of the labor, but the origins of that was never told and still isn't being told. And there's nothing wrong, there is a lot to wrong with that. But I also think what EDM culture actually also, on a positive side of it, brought to America is it actually brought electronic music back to America, because it was fucking nowhere before that. Europe had taken it all. We took it all. Like even speaking to Kevin on the podcast, like he was like, dude, I had to move to Amsterdam because I couldn't get booked in America. I had to go to Europe, like as in a city, like as their records.
And him saying that to you, the irony,
yeah,
you're over here
yeah.
doing your thing. He's got to go over there. It's like, what's happening?
Yeah, it's crazy.
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. But it's a conversation that I love the conversation because there's no answers to it.
Well, it's, dude, to me, it's this whole syndrome, part of it, whatever, a very small part of it, but it's this whole grass is greener.
Yeah, 100%.
Thing. Oh, man. Yeah, dude, oh, in Europe, dude, if you were to this place, Ibiza, they got all these clubs. I'm like, yeah, I've been there 1,000 times, dude. Yeah, I know about Ibiza.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I got it. It's amazing. It's crazy. Yes. You know, I went there 2 summers ago, dude. You've never seen anything like it. I haven't. Okay. You know, so whatever. It's always cooler somewhere else.
Yeah, 100%. And I actually like that. It actually makes me laugh. And I think we need that in this culture, because I think that it's like, There was a meme the other day that I saw on Instagram, and John won't mind me saying this, but it was like a John Summit. There was like a dude that commented on a John Summit about going to a John Summit show. And it was like, oh, I love techno so much. and like even John commented on it. It was kind of hilarious. But the thing is, the naivety, I love the naivety. I love the fact that actually these kids, it can be called what the fuck you want. Call it what the fuck you want.
Yeah.
It means nothing to any of us in the grand scheme of things, because we all know where it came from. And it is our place to kind of to push that, the history. But you know what? Did you ever listen to history when you were at school? Like, no one gave a fuck. No. The only reason why we know about history is because we became older and we got interested in it, right? And I think that's what the EDM culture did in America, is it actually built a foundation of kids that were interested in electronic music again. And that allowed the likes of myself, like you were kind of pushing that way to a certain extent of like building a scene back again for America, and allowing dudes like me that wasn't in the EDM culture at that time, that was making more underground records, an opportunity to tour in America, because promoters were like, oh cool, what's this dude doing now? And these kids that came to EDM shows that, and then was intrigued into the history, intrigued into learning a little bit more about, digging deeper, the dubstep phase of America. Like, although so many people talk so much shit on it, like, it brought so many people to the scene that are now listening to your records, my records, and everything. And I think there is a beautiful side to all of it as well. Although we can all laugh about it, but I think half the reason why I have success is because of that.
Yeah, listen, there's no Illenium selling out two nights at SoFi Stadium here in Los Angeles unless there's a Skrillex,
exactly,
you know, 10 years before him. So these things all kind of set one another up.
Yeah.
So it's cool, and I agree with you. It's like, at the end of the day, what does any of it matter? It's just like, okay, cool. I'm just really stoked and thankful that kids are paying attention. Yeah. And that I can have a career, whatever, man, making records, going out there and playing them. I have lived some kind of insane life.
I mean,
it's nuts.
It's crazy, and it's really interesting as well. And I've got friends that their first introduction to electronic music was you, and it's kind of that. How does that feel?
It's cool. It's awesome. I get those stories from time to time. I hate social media because it's something that takes time away from doing things that I love, but it's important. But the one thing I do love about it is it allows us to connect, and I can hear stories like that. And when I log on there, I search for kind of stories like that. Like, you know, the first song I ever heard was 4 AM, and I heard that and I fell in love with electronic music. I went and bought that album, Strobe Light Seduction, and it changed my life. And like, dude, it never gets old. I hear this stuff all the time. I think I was really fortunate that I was kind of on that. It's cool. I was with Ohm Records and Mark Farina and Derek Carter and doing this kind of boompty Chicago stuff. But I was like taking it from more of a songwriting approach. And I was fortunate because as kind of electronic music was rising, the thing that could cross over in America, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One of them is SiriusXM having a radio that 20 million people were subscribing to that had a dance station. And they were playing so much of my music because I was song-based. I was a songwriter. I was approaching it from a songwriter because I knew that was my angle. I was like, okay, I enjoy writing songs. Everyone's making beats. I'll make beats and I'll put it together. I'll write a song on top of that. That was kind of like, I understood that when I moved to San Francisco, I was like, this is my path. I think here's where I'm going to be able to fit in. Cause there was a handful of dudes doing that, Naked Music, Ohm Records. There was kind of like this, Miguel Miggs was having a moment. Solstice, the band, was having a moment, which, listen, there was a lot of stuff overseas that was kind of mirroring that. That was San Francisco's version of that. Anyway, what am I saying? I think the timing was really good for me.
Yeah.
Cause people who want more than just like some drums that aren't just like EDM people, but sonically we're looking for something interesting.
Yeah.
So they follow electronic music. And then I had songs on top of there that could easily kind of like grab onto mm-hmm. that. So I kind of opened up the door for, you know, a lot of people in their 20s. And then I think Apple Music was a big deal for me, kind of like online and streaming stuff. And those guys pushed that Strobe Light Seduction, that album. They really, I mean, dude, it was on the front page of the dance thing for like a month.
Yeah.
So anyone who logged on was like, what is this? And there were some, you know, I collaborated with Deadmau5 on two songs on that album. And, you know, whatever, the guy's wearing a glow in the dark helmet of the shape of a mouse. It's like, there were a lot of things that kind of just were stoking interest.
And that was 2008, right?
Somewhere around there. Yeah. 07, 08. So, yep. That's about, it was kind of like,
Bring
That's
the Night
when things were heating up.
Bring the Night album, 2007.
Yep.
Strobe Light.
That's a mixed comp.
Yeah. And then Strobe Light, 2008.
Yeah. So that was a big,
big year.
Huge year for me. Yeah.
My introduction to you was, I remember, as I'm sure it was a lot of people's introductions. Remember the first time I heard it, I had my residency in Ibiza at that time, and I probably still have it somewhere. When you at residencies in Ibiza back then, you'd have promo guys, and obviously instead of getting emails, you would get a dude that would come around with a bunch of CDs. And yep. you'd have to get that. You'd get those CDs and then put your reaction on it. I got that on a CD and remember listening to it. And that was when Deadmau5 was popping off at the same time. That record just completely changed Ibiza that year completely.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. I never forget that. It was almost like Cascade, Deadmau5, and I was like, Deadmau5 was having his time anyway at that time. He was like coming through, and then that came, and it was almost like both your worlds collide, and was like, fuck, like these guys can't do anything wrong. Did it feel like that when it actually happened?
Not quite like that. I knew it was a big moment.
Yeah.
Listen, Deadmau5 sent the instrumental to me. Let me give you a little bit of back. I've told this story 1,000 times, so I'll give you the super short version. I approached him because he was having a moment on Beatport, and that's when Beatport was so important. Because it's globally, we could see what was trending for the first time ever.
Yeah.
But prior to that, you remember, dude, you'd have to go to the record shop and be what's happening? Oh, this record's big, that record's big, whatever. And you're having these conversations with all the dudes that like live, eat, and breathe this, you know? But now we had that global trending barometer of the top 10, and he'd had a couple things hit. And I approached him and I'm like, dude, to me, I heard Faxing Berlin and I was like total Chicago house guy at this point. I'm like, dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum. I mean, just like, that's all I'm making. I heard that and I was like, what is happening here? Yeah. This sound design is some other, totally other thing. Cause in our world and in like generally speaking in most Americans' world, and certainly in the producer realm, trance and what was going on in Europe, we just looked at it as like garbage. Yeah. We were so like, that stuff was so, it's fast, it's super synthetic, it's not cool, it's like this Euro trashy, like that stuff's weird, and like we just didn't get it. Like we're over here like scots, you know.
You were also very right. Let's just be honest.
Trance just like wasn't working here, really, in the cool guy circles, in the big clubs, whatever. It was like smashing it, whatever, in the like four or five of those in the US. And so when I hit up Deadmau5, I'm like, dude, send me something. I'll write a song over this. Yeah. Let me write something, man. I've got 10 different girls I'm working with. Anyway, he sends it over, and I was like, oh, the chords on this are so freaking sick. I write something that night, record it the next day, send it to him like 2 days later, 3 days later. He's like, oh, this is shit hot. And I'm like, dude, this is such a record, right? I'm like, oh my gosh. And dude, I didn't know Deadmau5 something to that. I mean, this is all happening over freaking AIM.
Yeah.
It was all over Instant Messenger, like going back and forth. And for me, it changed things in America immediately. Mm. For sure. Like, cool. So it changed things. But to me, I still was like, I saw Deadmau5 playing in Europe a lot.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, I'm not getting the calls that he's getting. And the way it kind of seemed from my vantage point certainly changed my life, dude. Like, in so many ways. But I was like, oh, in Europe, they think I'm the person singing that song.
Oh, wow. Is that what
they don't know, that I'm just like a producer, that I'm a songwriter, that I'm like just a producer, that I'm just this dude doing this. So a lot of the gigs, I'd go to Europe and they're like, are you going to sing? And I'm like, the guy would come to pick me up at the airport, like, what? And I'm like, yeah, dude, what do you think?
Yeah.
You know? So I had a lot of weird moments on the road. And even for me, it really, dude, I'm showing up and I'm, you know, Chicago, Derek Carter Records, yeah. A lot of like what the Wicked Crew was doing, a lot of like Naked Music on records, some of the stuff that was happening down in LA. So I was still very housey.
Yeah.
And that was like kind of this smooth proggy stuff. So I quickly had to start like really learning more about that sound and working into my sets. What I thought was interesting about Deadmau5's sound when I reached out to him, I was like, to me, it was like house. It just was more synthetic. Like I totally understood it. Like I was instantly intrigued, but it didn't feel like a really big departure from what I was doing.
Yeah.
It just had more reverb on it. You know, like it was less sampley and more synth based, but yeah. I was like, that's cool. I can get with that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it definitely changed things, but dude, it's back to that previous conversation. It changed things for me kind of just in my world, just expanded. It didn't necessarily bring me overseas. And when it did, it just was a lot of awkward nights and weird conversations. I mean, I played a ton of gigs and 2009, 2010, 2011, I was going over to Europe a lot more, but it just, I didn't have the shtick. I didn't have the mouse head. I didn't have, like, I was still just like this dude showing up in a black t-shirt, like ready to like grind it out at 3 a.m. Like I don't know. I was still like this just kid from San Francisco, like playing cool records. Like, I don't know. I didn't. Yeah. The whole like show phase of what I was doing hadn't gotten there yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What? So moving on from that, and I'm sure you've told these stories a million times, and I'm sorry, but I don't know this, and I'm just really intrigued.
It's good.
but at what point were you like, I need to make a show of Cascade? I need to really make this a brand, I guess, use it without sounding too wanky. Yep.
It was all at that time, those years following that. Well, I could see, obviously everyone saw what Daft Punk did, right? And listen, in the US, all the Chicago dudes, Sneak, I mean, the original guys, they were all down with Daft Punk, right? That wasn't this like Euro cheese stuff. That was dope. Yeah. And that's Cry2More and all, dude, there were so many French labels doing disco. And quite frankly, they were doing it better than what the Chicago guys were.
Yeah.
They were filtering the stuff better. The mix downs were better. The records were punchier. The arrangement was better. It's like they just were like taking, it was like Chicago 2.0. But anyway, I was looking at all that and I'm like, oh, this is going bigger. Things are happening. Cascade just isn't like me showing up and being a cool guy and playing a couple cool records at 2 a.m. I gotta get like press shots. I gotta grow my team. I gotta be up on social media. This is a thing. And it really kind of coincided, talk about giving people props, like Donnie's one of the promoters, Disco Donnie here, that like he's been in the trenches for 30 years.
Yeah.
Pasquale Rotella, who owns Insomniac, another guy. I mean, I've known Pasquale for almost 25 years now. This guy's been booking me, playing shows, which is mind boggling. But they're the guys who like really put in the work. But I remember going to EDC and I was playing on some little side stage, whatever, but I walked into the Coliseum and I watched what was happening. And I was just like, I mean, it just like cracked my head open. Yeah. And was like, okay, the interest is here for me. How do I do from, you know, the 1,000-person club that's like going off a sweaty night to this, a stage, a show, a presentation, a whole experience? Like, how do I do that to this? And that's just really kind of, luckily I had a lot of really cool people around me. I had a guy, my creative director for many years, Lauren Kronk. Dude, I was the first guy to, I like saying this on podcasts and stuff because it's one of my little claims to like, I did this. I was the first guy to show up to EDC where I was like, I actually have my own visuals.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'm sorry, what? And we had advanced this because prior to that, everyone just showed up and they put, they had one visual guy for the entire festival. Mm. No one showed up with their own visuals. And I'm like, no, no, no. While I play Angel on My Shoulder, I have this specific graphic that this guy is going to put on and he's going to tap it in. The software at the time was in beta. It was so new. And like I paid this kid, Mike Burakoff, incredible, and Lauren Kronk, kind of we all gathered around and I'm going to play these 10 songs and I want these specific graphics. And we started coming up with stuff, but it was all kind of coincided with this huge, you know, wave of popularity with EDC. And that's really when I was like, okay, so, you know, early 2010 is when I'm like, all right, this is bigger than me.
Yeah.
I need to become Cascade.
Yeah. Is that transition though, was there any point in that transition where you're like, am I doing the right thing? Or was it the case I need to do this?
Every day, dude. I'm sure every artist out there second guesses themselves. But I don't spend a lot of time doing that. I'm like, I'm a person who's constantly in motion. I'm like, next. I don't, if I made a mistake, I don't have time to think about it. I'm just like, let me correct in the future. I'll just course correct, whatever. Just, I'm all about next. What's next? Keep going. So, if I was like, man, I wish I would have done that. Okay, cool. How can I avoid doing that in the future? I'm always like, okay, what can I learn from, you know, these things?
Yeah.
But I just was like, what's next?
On that, what's next? I can relate massively. And I think my team kind of hate me for it to a certain extent. but how... is the what's next can be extremely mentally draining. Like on another level. And to the extent where like I was having a joke earlier with one of my friends. She was like talking about a record that's recently come out and she was like, oh, it's doing really well. And I'm like, it's doing all right. Like, could be doing better, could be doing worse. It's doing all right. And she was like, why can't you just accept that it's doing well? And my manager hates me for this. and I think, bear in mind, people that are listening, this is being recorded in February. This is not when this is being released. So we're talking about very different records. But I think, like, how have you dealt with that mentally of the what's next thing? Because you've had some huge moments in your career, song-wise, show-wise. And when you're at the top, the pinnacle of a scene, which you were or are, at, like, there's not much bigger, right, than where you can go. How is that mentally?
Thank you. That's nice of you to say. I think it's really hard.
Yeah.
I think it's been a challenge. I think, like you, it's extremely difficult for the people around me.
Yeah.
And this is something that I've had to step back and be like, okay, cool. As a person, I need to do better at this. I mean, literally, I'm finishing my night in 2012. I'm the first guy to sell out Staples Center in our genre. And they're presenting me some big plaque and this thing, you know, and I'm playing in front of 18,000 people, whatever. Like that night, we check in, we kind of finish the hurrah, whatever, the show's over. We're kind of coming down, you know, 2 hours later, like, okay. And I've got my team around me. And I'm like, all right, cool. What are we doing in San Francisco? Like, what's going on with this? Where's that remix at? Did they send me the stems? And these guys are like, dude, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Because I get it. Listen, now that I've had more time in my, you know, whatever, 10, 12 years ago in my youth, it's just like, it's important to take those moments and celebrate the victories. Like, cool, wow, we just did that.
Yeah.
And kind of sit in it and enjoy it. I think for me, and that what's next, it's easy to turn the page really quick, and quicker than the people that are around you, because they've helped you get there, right? So yeah, it's important that they feel like they're ready to like move on to the next thing as well, and that you stroke them and that you have that moment and like say thank you and appreciate everything that they added there. I think it's been a challenge, you know, people working with me, because I'm always like, that was awesome, thank you, we crushed it, woo, yeah, next thing, what's up, man? Yeah. We're moving to Chicago, we got the show in 2 months, like where's the visuals for that, you know? And I'm like, ah. So I think that's hard. I think it is hard. Exhausting and whatever. I think that's one of those things that when I took, you know, 2022 off and or 2020 and like, okay, cool, I can do this better and I need to enjoy these moments. I mean, even listen, for me, we're just recording this shortly after the Grammys. I went to the Grammys on Sunday and it's my seventh trip going there, my eighth nomination. And it's always a really, really hard day for me. Because the pageantry of this, of like, okay, we get dressed up and we pat ourselves on the back and tell each other how awesome we are. It's like, it's a really, it's just not who I am. Yeah. I don't, but I've had to be like, look, the first time I went, I came home and I was like, I hate this. I'm never going again. But I've had to reframe it in my mind and be like, nah, man, this is cool. Even though that award doesn't mean anything to me, this hardware, it's what it symbolizes. It's what that day symbolizes to me and my team. Totally. All this hard work through the year or years that we've been together, let's take a day, let's have a nice meal, let's get dressed up and go and listen. Even though I go there and I'm like, I don't have barely anything in common with almost anyone in this room. Our experiences are so different. Yeah. Like, are we even in the music industry? Like, we make music, we both listen to the end product. Like it's just such a different thing that it's hard to feel like some kind of kinship with these people. But what I've reframed it as is like, let's take a moment and a breath and really enjoy the successes that we've had together. So it's cool because I have my team fly in. You know, they're not from here, he's from Toronto, my manager's from Toronto, but my agent's here, and like we all fly in and we kind of just enjoy the day. We have a big dinner the night before and we tell stories about, remember that time in Europe where they thought you were gonna sing? Like, you know, and we share these things, and it's kind of cool to take that moment. You can't be running around all the time, because all you're going to do is just piss everyone off around you and you're going to be exhausted yourself. So
it's precious. It's precious moments like that. And I think I can only speak for myself. It's sometimes very hard for me to sit in the moment and enjoy the journey and enjoy the moment. And it's the one thing that I don't really like giving advice. And I know that my advice will always go unheard, not unheard, but unnoticed, purely because everyone has to work it out themselves. That's my view on advice generally. But when somebody asks me, like, what, how do you become successful in the music industry, or what bit of advice would you give to me? It would always be try and enjoy the moments in the journey, because there's been plenty of moments for me, plenty of times for me where it's just like, I've enjoyed it, but I'm not thinking, like, I'm on stage thinking about why I'm on this stage, not this stage.
Why am I playing at 10 p.m. instead of 1 a.m.? Exactly. That bitch over there is playing 1 a.m. and I've got 7 records and I've been doing it 10 years longer.
Exactly.
Yeah, dude.
Exactly.
And it's, dude, how many times are the people that are listening to this, or you or I, how many times have you read, enjoy the journey?
Yeah, yeah.
Enjoy the fruits of this, because you're never going to be right here in this moment. 1,000 times, and you're right. But literally, if you can take anything away from this podcast, is that, because that time what I spent in my basement, I wouldn't change it for anything. Those 5 years where I was like gaining weight and eating pizza every day. But it's like, dude, what a time, you know, like what, like I wouldn't be here if I didn't have that. And it was fun and silly and stupid. And I did stay up all night working on some remix that was due the next day. And like, and it still sucked. And like all of those mistakes or errors, or it's like, yeah, you need to embrace it, because those are the moments that really kind of define this whole process. So I don't know, me just with age, I think comes a little bit, you know, learning to do that better. Yeah. I mean, I think I had the most fun at the Grammys this year than I've ever had. The last two times that I've gone, I've been able to bring this time I brought my entire family. The last time my littlest one was too small, but I mean, I'm there, I've got my wife and my three girls.
That's precious.
And for me, the most rewarding part was just seeing my girls on the red carpet, and they were just like, dude, they were loving it.
Love
and
that.
I'm like, this is so cool. When they get older, you know, they'll be like, my dad took me to the Grammys. Yeah. And like, I'm just like, this, it's not about me. It's like this, that I'm making these memories and having this cool moment. It's not about me. Like, who cares, man? Whatever. Like, I don't care, dude.
No, yeah. It's cool. I love that. I love that, because really thinking about it, none of what we're doing is about you and I. None of it. We play records to thousands of people, hundreds of people, thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, and we're not there for me. I'm not there for me. I'm there for them. I'm there to play music for them, and I have to come. I have to turn on the minute I get on stage. You have to turn on the minute you get on stage, because if you're not there, they're not going to have a good time, and they have to have a good time. It's exactly the same with what you're saying about your family. Is like, you're not doing it for you now. You're doing it for them. You're doing it to make those memories for them, which is so precious. And I think if you, that's about, for me, it's just about taking the ego out of it. And it's like, none of these people were here to see me. I'm here to play music for them, and hopefully they fucking like it. If not, I'm game over. I'm playing at 9 p.m. next year. KX5, I feel like we have to talk about it. And Escape. Crazy record.
Big record.
Crazy record.
Yeah.
Do you know the history?
What do you want to know? Oh, there's history. There's a lot of history. Joel and I, whatever, we wrote I Remember and Move for Me, you know, 15 years ago. I always thought there's an opportunity for us to do things more together. But really, he was on that rocket ship, especially 15 years ago. I mean, it was so, and when somebody's burning really hot, it's hard to be like, hey, I'm not burning as hot as you, but let's do some stuff together. That never really works.
Yeah.
Like, you have to both feel like you're getting something out of that for the collaboration to work well. So anyway, now, you know, fast forward 15 years, whatever, 12 years, and it was like, hey, let's do some stuff together. he played me the song Escape. He was in LA, he came to the studio. He's like, hey man, what do you think of this? And it was in pretty demo mode. He'd worked on it, but he's like, I don't totally know how to like wrap this up. Like, I can't see it because I've been in it. I've had the record for like a year.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know what to do. And I'm like, all right, stem it out. Let me just sit with it for a minute. And I kind of added that last like 20%, 30%.
Yeah.
I got it to the finish line. I sent it to him and he's like, yeah, dude, this is it. This is what it needed. And I was like, cool. And then I'm like, dude, I've got a handful of tracks laying around that I think are special. I don't totally know what to do with these. Maybe we do more than just a song. Maybe let's turn this into an idea, you know? And I kind of came to him like, you know, like name it something. And then we could like play some festivals and shows under this name, whatever. So we kind of started spitballing. I sent him some songs. He sent some stuff back and we kind of went back and forth. And I think, I don't know if you agree with this, but I feel like the whole back-to-back thing is just in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years just become really kind of like, oh, this is another cool outlet. It's a thing that's happening. Yeah. People can do it. And we didn't, Joel was very, I mean, you know, Joel, he's got ideas and he wants to do it his way, which is cool. He's like, dude, let's make it more like a band. And I'm like, that I'm all on board with that. I think that makes a lot of sense. But I knew people would be open it because the whole back-to-back thing was so prevalent now. So anyway, we put the record Escape out. It gained traction. It did well. You know, we kind of produced it in a way that I thought the older fans would appreciate. I mean, it sounded like I Remember 2.0 or Move For Me 2.0, like in that same kind of production style, but a 2023 version of it, or 2022, you know. So I was happy with it. And then we went out and did a couple shows, and I mean, the interest is there. We're gonna do, I think we've got one or two shows scheduled for this year as well. It's kind of like now we're just more like, okay, let's see where the interest lies, and you know, we'll kind of take it there. Last year was a big push, we rolled it out and did those shows, and now we're just like, let's see what, you know, what bubbles up.
Yeah. Amazing, man. Do you know my relationship with Escape?
I don't.
If you looked,
tell me, dude. This is great. When you're saying history, you were talking about that. Give me the history. Did you do a demo of it?
Have you looked at the credits?
Did you have that record? I have not. I've never looked at the credits, dude. Are you in there? Are you a songwriter on that?
Yeah.
This is insane. So do you know Halo? You can't even believe I'm putting this together right now for the very first time. I've never looked at the credits.
Yeah. So, it was originally a Will Clark song.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy, hey?
So did the vocal come to... How did Halo...
I wrote...
It. How did you...
There was four of us in the studio and we wrote it together.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who else is a writer on this? Camden Cox in on that?
Camden and Eddie Jenkins. Crazy. Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's a beautiful
record. So did you come up with it? And did you guys, dude, hey, Hala smashed it. The performance is
awesome.
She's
the best, man. She's, that was my first session with Hala. And she was at that point in her career, and she won't mind me saying this about her, but she was a singing teacher in Liverpool or Manchester at the time. And we'd just got in the studio together and we were sat outside. And like, I'd heard her voice. Like, it's a fucking amazing voice. And I was like, she was like, oh, I'm an RN about moving to London because I kind of want to try this whole like singer-songwriter thing out properly, like full time. And I was like, you have to move to London. Like, you can't do this living in the north of the UK. You have to go full in on London for you to do this.
Like, go in on it.
Go in.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was the first session we did together. And yeah, it was like,
dude, you're blowing my mind right now. This is awesome. So hold on. But then my question is, so when you finish the session,
yeah,
you come up with escape.
Yeah.
Do you feel like, hey, this is my record, I think I could put this out? Or are you like, man, we should shop this around, this is a pop record, like Britney Spears could cut this, or Beyonce? Were you guys like, whoa, this is another thing, we hit something here?
You want the honest truth, which nobody really knows publicly, and this can be cut out if not, and I'm more than happy for it to be cut out. It was supposed to be a Will Clark release, and then one of the writers got wind that it could be a little bit more successful than just a Will Clark release, and completely blocked the record, blocked me from releasing it.
Hey, listen, if it makes you, I think this should be in the podcast, I don't know, probably somebody will get pissed, but if it makes you feel any better, dude, this has happened a dozen times to me in my career.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can imagine.
Because I really like, I enjoy the songwriting process.
Yeah.
And what's even crazier, so when you sit in there and you're collaborating, you're writing a song, and then somebody's like, oh, you know, some manager gets in one of the writer's ear that you don't know, this could be huge, we're going to pitch it to freaking Beyonce or whatever, whatever they say.
Yeah.
Listen, this goes back to the ego part of it, right? If you could remove that, whatever. But it's a shame, because I would say 99% of the time, in my experience, nothing ever happens with the records. Nothing.
Yeah.
They go on to do nothing. And I'll go back and visit them 3 years later, like, whatever happened to this? Yeah, nothing.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, so you could get your ego stroked by some guy that's trying to make you some money, like, whatever. Like, I told you, man, we should have put this out 3 years ago. Yeah, I'm not even interested anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's a shame.
It's a crazy, but I think the thing for me is like, because it initially went to Joel, initially, and then there was something that happened there that it didn't go to Joel, and then it went to Chris Lake, and Chris, the interesting thing with Chris,
had a version of it.
Yeah, Chris and I are pretty close, and also Chris started the management. Chris started the management company with my manager that Ryan is. Initially started before he moved to 360. And then Ryan told Chris about the whole drama behind this record. And Chris was like, fuck that, I don't want anything to do with this record. And then I got to the point where I was like, I'd move on from the record. Like, I loved it. I loved it. Like, I loved it. But like you said, we moved on. Like, these things happen. We write so much music that we all move on. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, Cascade and Deadmau5 want to do something with it. I'm like, cool, crack on. And then I heard it. I was like, this is perfect. This makes sense. And you know what? If I take my ego out of it, the record, I don't know, which is the beautiful thing, but the record, my version of the record, wouldn't have done what you guys have done with the record, which means that the record wouldn't have been heard by as many people. It wouldn't have been as successful. And at the end of the day, for me, it's all about the record. It's all about how many people get to listen to that record. And that moment that we had in the studio, although yes, there's some very salty conversations that's happened since that record got written, like,
right,
the record is a beautiful record, and it's got a platform that was way bigger than mine at the time, and it's fucking done so well. It's done so well,
dude. Massive tune. You're a good man, and you're in a good spot, dude, that you could say that, because a lot of people, they hold on to that.
Yeah.
And it's hard for them, because when you do take the ego out of it, really and truly, that's it. But listen, because it's working for you either way. It's out there doing its thing, and you're collecting your publishing checks and whatnot. And like, you moved on and you're going to make more records. It's like, it doesn't. And the few records that got away from me, I'm kind of like, there's nothing to be bitter about.
No.
It's cool. I participated. I did my thing, and that's awesome. Like, let it. Like, some pop star has a much bigger platform than I do.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to play for millions of people. That's awesome. Let them do it.
Yeah. And so. And I think it's it to be able to get to that point about how you look at music is really important to me, because I think it's not that important. It's only fucking house music that we're in.
So, that's it, dude. We got wars raging, exactly. Stuff's going on. We're over here just screwing around in the club on the weekend trying to have a good time. Like, honestly, man, all the rest of it's just like noise. That's why I'm like, whatever.
Yeah, I love it, man. I love it. What's your...
I'm stoked that you got to tell that. Dude, I'm so glad we put that together.
I'm amazed because, yeah, I love that you didn't know, because I genuinely thought that you would know that there was, like, that I was part of it, which is why I thought is the reason why you spoke to me in the first place. Like, I was like, yeah, clearly he's talking to me because he knows that I helped write Escape. But yeah, that's amazing. I'm really glad that you guys got the record, because there was nobody else that I think would have been able to make that record still sit so well in the electronic music world, but have a huge commercial appeal to it as well.
It's a good one. Well, thank you for writing that or participating in the writing. It's awesome. It's a great record, and it's cool that you were there for Hala, dude.
She's great. She's great. I mean,
she's making some moves. It's fun to see.
Yeah, I was talking to her last night actually, and she's like, it's amazing to see. I'm so happy for her. She's one. Have you like spent much time with her?
A little bit. On those first few performances, we kind of got to hang out a little bit. Yeah. Not much, but a little. You know,
dude,
she seems like a great girl.
Get her in the studio, like. Just everything that comes out of her mouth is just sounds like it's from heaven. It's ridiculous. I've got so many sessions with her, and you're just like, oh man, it's just, you could just listen to the voice. It's so good. There's not many people out there that have that. They write music for their voice. They don't write music for anybody else. It's purely for them, and their voice fits their lyrics and fits their songs. And if somebody else writes music for them, it doesn't really work. And there's just not many artists that can do that. And she can just do that in a whole nother level, man. I love it.
Yeah.
So going back to what you were saying with regards to planning your years out. I know this isn't coming out in February, but we're in February now. How differently did you look at planning 2024 out, and what's the goal for 2024 for the Cascade project?
I think I'm in this space now where I want to get a handful of new songs out this year. You know, I've always been an album guy. Just because I like working on albums, because you can be like, cool, you can sit in the studio and write and write and write. And out of that process, you're going to have one or two or three songs on that album that work at 1:30 in the morning or 2 in the morning. And it's a hands in the air, kind of like, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I haven't put an album out in 6 years, but for the first 15 years of my career, I was putting out an album about every year and a half. I was just like album, because instead of like going to have that pressure of like, I gotta make a single, I was like, I'll just make an album and then we'll get some bits in there.
Yeah.
That's how I work. Mm. When the listening, you know, changed for everyone, and how people consume music, it was so singles based, it's been really difficult for me to kind of manage that process. So now I kind of said in an earlier interview, I forget what it was. I really want to put out a record this year. I don't think it's going to happen. I'm looking at my year. I think it's probably going to come out at the beginning of next year. Cool. But I'm going to be writing a lot this year with that goal in mind. Mm-hmm. If it happens at the end of the year, great. If not, great, whatever. It'll happen early next year. I'll get there. I'm not one of these guys. I like to have like, cool, I'm going to write for these 2 months and that's going to be the album. That's kind of how I typically do it. So that's, I've set time aside this summer. It's going to happen. I've got a few things in the oven, some kind of interesting collaborations. Those will be coming out this year. So I'll have a handful of singles come out this year and that'll either culminate in an album or early next year. And then, you know, yeah, then I'm doing about, I don't know, probably around 60 shows here in North America and then probably another 20 or 30 shows outside the US, you know.
It's a good number.
So I'm kind of like, keep that balance. Yeah, for me, the magic number is right around 80.
Yeah.
Where I feel like, oh, I have a life.
Yeah.
And I've learned that since the lockdowns. Like, oh, I have a life. I have a studio. I can still like do things and have relationships.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So. Yeah, I think it's also having, being able to catch up with friends as well as family. I know obviously family is important, but I think the dynamic of spending time with friends is so important, which I think it gets really kind of messed up in our touring world because some friends come on tour, but then still you're touring. Like I get quite a few friends, especially in the UK, that because I don't get the chance to see them, when I do a show in Europe, they all come. Or when I do a show in the UK, they all come, which is great. I fucking love it. But like, it's still work for us.
Yeah.
And there's still that no time to switch off. And I think for me is like making time to see friends and family, obviously, but like friends, just to get that time in is so important.
It's a big deal and was overlooked by me for a long, long time. Yeah. So yeah, I am in that mode now. So
love it.
Trying really hard to strike the balance, right?
Cool, man. Dude, let's wrap it up. We've just done an hour and a half. Thank you so much for coming on. Really look forward to catching up in person at some point. But yeah.
Yeah. Big this love, was man. Awesome, man. Thanks for the invitation. Loved it.
Thanks for coming on. Big love, man. And that's a wrap. Big love to Cascade for coming on. Thanks for listening. Please share it. Please send it to your people. Hit like, hit subscribe. Till next time, people. Keep safe.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at UH1.com.